Hi. Thank you, Chris, and thank you to Tim and Matt here at the library, the Ann Arbor District Library. I grew up in a very small town in Central Florida, and the highlight of my week was always going to the library on Tuesday afternoons. So this is both an honor and a delight to get to share some knowledge with you all tonight. So as Chris mentioned, the title of my talk is "Is the News Fake and the Facts Alternative? Why People Hear What They Want to Hear and How to Bridge the Divide." So I'd like to start with a quote. It's a quote from Edgar Madison Welch, and the quote is, "The intel on this wasn't 100%. Does anyone know who Edgar Madison Welch is? Any guesses? CIA, that's a great guess. Not quite. Edgar Madison Welch is this guy. Does anyone recognize this guy? Pizzagate, yeah, Pizzagate. Now you see where we're going. Okay, so Edgar Madison Welch, with his rifle, came across some information on the internet, and that information came out of WikiLeaks. And the information that he came across were summaries of this guy's emails. Does anyone know who this guy is? John Podesta. That's right, John Podesta. DNC affiliate John Podesta. His emails were hacked and spread online on WikiLeaks. And in the trove of emails, some internet bloggers found references to cheese pizza. And so they interpreted this information about John Podesta's emails as not being about his preference for Italian food, but rather the initials for cheese pizza, CP, being in reference to another acronym for CP, child pornography. And so they read his emails about cheese pizza and his love of cheese pizza as a reference to child pornography. And from there, a child pornography ring orchestrated by the leaders of the Democratic Party, including a sadistic cult that operated in the basement of Comet Ping Pong Pizza in Washington, D.C. And so Edgar Madison Welch, being the stand-up guy that he is, took his rifle, crossed state lines from Virginia into Washington, D.C., and shot three shots into the Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria in the hopes of disrupting the child sex ring / satanic cult that was operating in the basement of the pizzeria. Much to his dismay, or perhaps not, upon arriving at Comet Pizza, he realized there was neither a child pornography ring nor a basement. So the information that he received online was fake. It was false information. People had interpreted the information in a way that was consistent with their own beliefs. Those beliefs spread, and Edgar Madison Welch acted on that information that he had received. And so this has been talked about in the media as an example of fake news. And so I want to make sure that we're all on the same page about what fake news is. Fake news is not a new term. So if you look at this comic going back all the way to 1894, you will see that fake news is a concept that has been around for a while. And typically what fake news refers to is deliberate misinformation or hoaxes, and it's spread via traditional news outlets. So it's purposefully fake information that's being spread into mainstream media. Now, what we mean in 2017 is a little different than that, right? So Donald Trump referring to fake news, heading back to Washington after working hard and watching some of the worst and most dishonest fake news reporting I have ever seen. And so now fake news as a term has taken on this connotation of being applied to either true or false statements with which one disagrees. And it also has expanded to include social media. So now, rather than traditional print or broadcasting outlets, fake news is also disseminated through social media. So the other term in the title of the talk is alternative facts. Alternative facts is a much more recent phenomenon. It emerged in January 2017. when Kellyanne Conway went on Meet the Press to talk about Sean Spicer's reporting of the number of people who had attended the presidential inauguration. So Kellyanne Conway, or Sean Spicer, had presented some information that was in contrast to other reports of the amount of attendees at the inauguration. And in defense of Sean Spicer's report, Kellyanne Conway labeled them alternative facts. Now, this launched a media firestorm in which the response on Meet the Press was alternative facts are not facts, they are falsehoods. So that was Chuck Todd's response to Kellyanne Conway. Kellyanne came back and said, alternative facts are additional facts or alternative information. So people can look at the same information and come to different conclusions. And that's how the term has been used in the popular press. And so now that I've talked about what these things actually mean, I want to go through very, very quickly what this talk isn't. So I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page here. So what this talk isn't, it's a discussion. This talk is not a discussion of the objective truth value of various pieces of news or why people may be motivated to spread false information. I am not going to talk about that. I'm not going to say whether or not a specific piece of news is true or false. That is not going to happen. I am not going to talk about this as a thinly veiled attempt to pick on members of one political party or the other. People on both sides of the political spectrum label things fake news, label things alternative facts, and we are, in fact, all susceptible to the biases I'm going to talk about tonight. And finally, this talk is not an exhaustive examination of all of the complexities involved in political discourse. I have 1 hour, less than that. I can't even begin to cover everything that could possibly contribute to this kind of discussion. So I'm going to take a very thin slice here. But what I am going to talk about, so what this talk is, it's a focus on information recipients. It's a focus on us as information consumers and how we handle news about topics we already have opinions about. It's an overview of some of the common pitfalls when evaluating information about which we already have opinions. And I'm going to talk about some of the consequences of these biases. So what are the outcomes of engaging in this kind of biased information processing? And then finally, I'm going to talk about some ways to reduce the bias and help bridge gaps. So if this is not what you wanted, you can leave now. I won't be offended, I promise. So things like, when do we discredit information we disagree with? Why do we discredit information we disagree with? What are the consequences of discrediting information we disagree with? And finally, how can we be less biased? So that's what we're going to talk about in the next 45 minutes or so. And so I'm going to preview the take-home message up front, just so we're all on the same page. Our brains are incredible. They are phenomenal information processors. So spoiler alert, your brain is awesome. It's incredibly efficient at processing huge amounts of data. Sometimes these efficiencies come at the cost of blind spots. So sometimes we make errors or biases in judgment. So we can process information very carefully if we need to, but sometimes we don't. And being aware of our biases can help reduce errors in our judgment. So how can one person's truth be another person's alternative fact? So we are more likely to discredit information we disagree with when we feel very strongly about the issue. So you may well have data smithers, but I have strong opinions, and I pay your wages. So when we feel strongly about the issue, we discredit it. When we disagree with the message, so cancel all my meetings, someone on the internet is wrong, I have to go argue some things. When we're angry, so I have a colleague here in the Comm Studies Department at the University of Michigan, Brian Weeks, who's looked at anger in response to political information and finds that when people are angry about political topics, they're way more likely to counter-argue and they're a lot more likely to engage in the biases that I'm going to talk about, especially in contrast to emotions like anxiety. So if we don't like who's saying it, we don't listen, we're more likely to disagree with the message. So hopefully that was what the experiment that we just ran here. And if we don't like the solution, so we discredit the message, not necessarily if we agree with the problem, but if we don't like the implied solution. So for instance, when an environmental problem means recycling your beer cans, this is important and we need to do something. When an environmental problem means taxes and sacrifices, it's a lie. So when we don't want to have to do what we need to do to fix the problem, one easy way of handling that is to pretend like the problem doesn't exist at all. And so when we think about processing this kinds of information, it's important to consider the motives that people bring. So what motives are at play? Why are people handling the information the way that they are? So you can think about, perhaps, you know, we're all smart, educated people here, that people would have an accuracy motive. That people, what they would want to do is they would focus on being correct. So as an information consumer, you can imagine moving around in the world trying to learn the right thing. You want to have all the facts and all the information so that you can be correct. You're like you thoughtfully consider the message, regardless of whether or not we agree. We take it in and process it really, really intentionally, really consciously, like detectives moving around in the world, making sure that we have all of the information and putting all of the pieces together. When we operate under an accuracy motive, when we are willing and able to process the message. So this means that we want to process the message, we want to take in all the information, and we have the cognitive resources available to do it. So we have time, we have energy, we can focus on what we're taking in. And we have an accuracy motive when we want to be right. When we want to be accurate, when we want to have all the facts, we operate with an accuracy motive. In contrast to an accuracy motive, a lot of the time, this would be things like fact check, like you'd fact check an argument. So if you come across media that you see and you're not sure whether or not it's true or false, you might further evaluate the claim, checking other objective resources to see whether or not the belief is true or false. So those are the kinds of things that you do when you're operating under an accuracy motive. We don't always do that. And sometimes we operate under a defense motive. And the defense motive is really about focusing on protecting your current beliefs. So it's the idea of like, whoa. I have this figured out. I know what I think already. I don't need to learn anything else. I'm good here. It's about maintaining stability of the system. So this tends to operate when we favor messages we agree with and we ignore, counter-argue, or derogate the source of messages that we disagree with. So we pretend that there's no information out there. We actively say that person is wrong for thinking that thing, or they're an idiot for how could you possibly believe that this thing is true. And defense motives tend to be at play when we care about the issue. So for things that feel really relevant for us, something that we're really passionate about, we're way more likely to be defensive than we are to want to be accurate. When we're pressed for time or when we're tired, when we don't have the ability to really thoughtfully consider whether the new piece of information that we're receiving is true or false, we're just going to use our pre-existing attitudes as a guide for how to decide whether or not something's true or false. And we want to feel right. And this is in contrast to being right. We just want to feel right. It feels so good to feel like you knew all along, right? What's that sound? Oh, that's the sound of me saying I told you so, right? Like, how good does it feel to feel right? And sometimes that's enough, right? We can just stop there. Whether or not it's true or not, it feels right to me, and that's good enough. And so how does focusing on defense change the way that we see information? So when we are trying to protect ourselves, protect our attitude systems from change, what kind of things do we do? So what does being defensive do? Well, one thing that it does is it changes what we expect to see. So what we expect to see, we see what we expect to see. And so one of the original studies on this topic looked at news coverage of the Beirut massacre, so from 1982. And what the Vallone, Ross, and Lepper, what they were interested in doing was looking at how pro-Israeli audiences and pro-Palestinian audiences viewed the same news coverage. So everyone saw the same news coverage. For example, here, the cover of Time magazine, they sourced clips from all of the major broadcast media at the time. And what they found is that people who were pro-Israeli, thought that the news coverage was biased against their side. And people who were pro-Palestinian, did they think that the news was pro-Palestinian? No. They thought that the news was pro-Israeli. So people looked at the news and thought, they are being biased against the thing that I like or the thing that I value, and they interpreted the news coverage in line with those views. So the pro-Israeli viewers saw the content as being not on their side, as antagonistic to their side, not as favorable as they wanted it to be, and the pro-Palestinian audiences felt the same way about their side. We also see this manifest today with things like labeling climate change versus global warming. And so if you ask people what they think about climate change, not about global warming, you find a decrease in partisanship by about 30%. So global warming is a loaded term that's associated with liberals. Climate change is less partisan. And when you talk about the same phenomenon using a different label, people's endorsement of whether or not climate change or whether or not global warming is happening also changes. And we see this also with Obamacare versus the Affordable Care Act. So they're the same thing, spoiler alert. They're the same thing, but people don't always know that. And when they see Obamacare, when they see the healthcare policy labeled Obamacare, their attitude about President Obama impacts their evaluation of the policies. So for people who are pro-Obama, they think Obamacare is great. And for people who are anti-Obama, they think that Obamacare is literally the worst thing that you could come up with. And if you label it the Affordable Care Act, those biases are reduced. And so Jimmy Kimmel actually did a skit, did a bit where he asked people about Obamacare versus the Affordable Care Act. And I'd like to show it to you now so you can see the kinds of things that people come up with.
These government shutdowns have happened before. Yeah, the last one was in 1996. But the debate on this one is particularly heated because people have such strong opinions about Obamacare. Interestingly, the polls show that most Americans say they don't like Obamacare, but they love what's in it when it all gets broken down. It's like the opposite of a McNugget. So, it's interesting. And when there are complicated issues to study, most people just side with whoever they usually side with. So I decided to conduct an experiment today. We sent a camera crew out on the Hollywood Boulevard to ask people which they thought was better, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Now, as you may know, Obamacare is just a nickname for the Affordable Care Act. They're the same thing. But lo and behold, we found people who did not know that, and that didn't stop them from weighing in on it.
We're talking about health care today, and which plan do you support, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act.
And what is it about Obamacare that you do not like?
I just think that there's a lot of holes in it, and it needs to be revamped. I think it's
and you think
it hasn't
the affordable,
been thought out.
You think the Affordable Care Act is a better plan than Obamacare?
Better, but I'm not happy with that either.
What do you agree with, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act?
I'm more sort of towards the Affordable Care Act, but I'm also there very sympathetic for people that don't have the ability to have proper medical insurance.
So the Affordable Health Care Act is still a better option than
yes.
Obamacare?
Yes.
And why do you not agree with the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think it's not really available for all.
So the Affordable Care Act is more affordable than Obamacare?
Just the name says it all.
Right. You would agree with the Affordable Care Act?
Absolutely. I think it's nice that everyone can afford it, and everyone should be able to afford it, but to force people to pay something and then doctors to make something, limiting their ability to do their job, that's kind of anti-American.
Right. So Obamacare is un-American?
I think it's kind of un-American to force people. What if they can't afford it? What if they want more coverage?
And the Affordable Care Act is American.
I think it's more American because it allows people to make their own choices on what they want and who they want to work with.
Do you agree with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare?
The Affordable.
And why do you prefer the Affordable Care Act over Obamacare?
I just don't agree with the whole Obamacare policy thing that's going on. I just don't agree with it.
And do you believe that an informed citizenry is essential to a democracy?
Yes.
So you disagree with Obamacare?
Yes, I do.
Do you think insurance companies should be able to exclude people with pre-existing conditions?
No.
Do you agree that young people should be able to stay on their parents' plans until they are 26?
They should be able to, yes.
Do you agree that companies with 50 or more employees should provide health care?
I do.
And so by that logic, you would be for the Affordable Care Act?
Yes.
What plan do you support, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act.
And why do you support that over Obamacare?
I do not like Obamacare. I don't like anything that has to be forced for everybody to buy. It's just not good.
Do you think Obamacare is socialist?
Yes, I do.
Do you think the Affordable Care Act is socialist?
No.
Do you believe that Obamacare will eventually lead to gun prohibition?
Yes.
Do you know that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act are the same thing?
No, they're not. Thanks, you made me look stupid.
That's what we do.
Okay, you did good.
So the label changes how we evaluate the information. And this happens, it's not just a conservative problem, it's an everyone problem. So the video didn't show it, but people on the pro side, people who support Obama, are more likely to favor Obamacare compared to the Affordable Care Act because Obama's awesome, even if they don't know what's actually in the plan. So in addition to seeing kind of what we expect to see, we search for new information that confirms what we already think. So going beyond just receiving the information, we actively seek out information that already confirms what we think. So for instance, I've heard the rhetoric from both sides, time to do my own research on the real truth, and then literally the first link that agrees with what you already believe, jackpot. Right? So it's like, I find the one thing that supports what I already think. Okay, cool. We're done here. Problem solved. And so this manifests in terms of media selection biases. So for instance, Republicans are more likely to watch Fox News. Democrats are more likely to watch MSNBC or listen to NPR or read the New York Times. And these are stereotypes about the parties, but it actually plays out in content that partisans seek out. So Republicans do report Fox News as the top source of news, and Democrats report a mix of things that include things like NPR, MSNBC, The New York Times, and CNN. In addition to us seeking out information on our own, we also elicit information sharing from our friends that confirms what we already think. And so this is some work that I've done with Mike Hall, who's a graduate student here at the University of Michigan. And what we find is that our friends give us what we want. Our friends are more likely to give us information that we already agree with, and they screen out information they think that we're going to disagree with. And the reason why is because they want to be good friends. They want to give us stuff that we like. They want to keep us away from stuff that we don't like. And the purpose of this is to help cement the bond. So the expectation is that people think that if they give their friends stuff that they like, their friends will like them more. And it turns out, when we ask people, they like people who give them stuff they agree with more. I know, right? And so how this manifests in life are things like biased Facebook feeds. So you share information with your friends who are more likely to share your political views. And what happens is that the same Facebook feed, so for instance, President Trump, it looks very different if you're a liberal versus a conservative. And what ends up happening is that we get into these ideological echo chambers where people who are on the extremes of the political spectrum, so both consistently conservative and consistently liberal partisans, are more likely to get biased information. So here, you see both the conservatives and the liberals are showing these biases to a larger extent than the people in the middle of the political spectrum. So these are things like, it's important to me to live in a place where most people share my political views and most of my close friends share my political views. So the more extreme our attitudes are, the more likely we are to create these echo chambers or information bubbles for ourselves. Being defensive also changes what we pay attention to. So even if we are exposed to information that we disagree with, which we have selected out both for ourselves and have our friends help us do, we also pay attention to information that confirms our preconceptions even when it's presented to us. So if you think back to the Watergate hearings, news coverage of Watergate So Watergate was a scandal where Richard Nixon, the guy on the left here, was accused of orchestrating some break-ins at Watergate to the detriment of his party. And his candidate, the candidate for the Democrats in the 1972 election, McGovern, was his opponent in the election. And so Sweeney and MacGruber in 1984 looked at coverage or political partisans' awareness of the information about Watergate. And what he found is that Nixon supporters were way less likely to have read coverage of Watergate, even though that information was available on both sides in all of these outlets. McGovern supporters were far more likely to have paid attention to the Watergate scandal, coverage of the Watergate scandal. And what part of what we're doing here is that we perceive information that confirms our preconceptions as more valid. So it's not that just it's not just that we seek it out, it's not just that we pay attention to it, we also code it as better quality information. So we see the same information when it agrees with us as being more valid than information on the other side. So, for instance, did you fact check this before reposting it? I don't need to. It agrees with my preconceived views and biases, so it must be true. So we label things that support our views as valid, credible, reliable, compared to information that contradicts our views. And so Michael Hall and I have also done some studies looking at evaluation of gun control information, and we find that people who are pro-gun control evaluate arguments on the pro side as being more credible, more valid, more reliable, stronger, more well-written than information on the other side. But people who are anti-gun control see the anti-gun control information as being stronger, well-written, more reliable, more credible, and more valid than the information on the other side. It's the same information. So what does being defensive do? Well, it changes what we seek out, it changes what we pay attention to, and it changes how we evaluate new information. So our beliefs can impact how we handle new information. So it changes what we seek out, what we attend to, what we evaluate. So what's the big deal? So what? So what if I want to read what I want to read? What does it matter? So what if I think that my belief is right? What does it matter, right? Like, who is it hurting if I think the thing and seek out information that confirms my view? What's so wrong? It feels so good. What's so wrong about being defensive all the time? So what are the consequences of this kind of bias processing? Well, one thing is that what we pay attention to predicts what we think. So the information that we get impacts our beliefs going forward. So things like views of healthcare laws by news source, support for the travel ban by news source, heading in the right direction, whether or not the country is headed in the right direction, and even evaluations of President Trump vary as a function of what news media we pay attention to. So conservative news outlets are up here, and then liberal news outlets are down here. So the list of outlets ranges from conservative to liberal. And so as you can see, as the news outlets shift from conservative to liberal, whether or not people pay attention to those news sources changes their support for different political policies or candidates. What we pay attention to also predicts what we do. So not only does it impact what we think, it impacts what we do with that information. So it can change our voting intentions. So for instance, the data that I told you about a minute ago about validating gun control information, what we find is that whether or not you validate that information predicts how you vote. So if you validate pro-gun control information, you vote a pro-gun control way. If you validate anti-gun control information, you vote in an anti-gun control way. And that is controlling for your attitude. So exposure to the information, validation of the information that you received, changes how you vote. It can also change sentencing recommendations. So Emily Balchettis and her colleagues did a study where they showed participants a video of an arrest. And so they looked at where people paid attention, if they looked at the perpetrator of the offense or if they looked at the police officer. And when people looked at the perpetrator, they were way less likely to assign a heavier sentence than when people looked at the police officer. So where people were focusing their attention changed how punitive they were willing to be towards someone, a perpetrator of a crime. So what we pay attention to also predicts more extreme attitudes. So it creates partisanship. So the idea now of reaching across the aisle is now pointing across the aisle. And so in the last 25 years, there's been an increase in the amount of political partisanship. So you can see in 1994, the median Democrat and the median Republican were actually not that far off. And then over time, those medians are drifting apart, are slowly drifting apart. And so now we've ended up with much more political partisanship than there was even 20 years ago. Our expectations, so our beliefs, also lead us to act in ways that cause others to confirm those very expectations. So imagine entering into a discussion with someone of the other political ideology, whatever that political ideology is. Now imagine an interaction that you're going to have with this person, and imagine that you expect that person to be hostile. What are you going to do? How do you act? What are you going to do gearing up for the conversation with someone who disagrees with you that you expect to be hostile? Yeah, go ahead.
You wouldn't say what you really think.
You wouldn't say what you'd really think? Maybe?
Unless you really want to fight.
Unless you want to fight. Oh, okay. So you might keep your opinion to yourself.
I might disregard what they have to say.
You might disregard what they have to say? What?
You might disregard what they have to say.
You just ignore them altogether.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to speak into the mic because we're filming this. So if you're going to take questions, I'll come around with the mic.
Oh, okay.
I was going to say you might disregard what the person has to say and think they're really out there.
Okay, so you might just completely disregard what they're going to say as being really out there. Yeah.
I would probably get my facts straight for my side first.
Okay, so you want to make sure that you have all your facts straight before you engage in this debate. Why? Why do you have your facts straight?
Just in case they start attacking me, I can be defensive and ready.
Okay, so you are already gearing up. You are ready. You are ready for the fight, yeah? So you expect to go into this interaction with someone who's going to be hostile to you. You got to get your facts straight. You got to get ready to run because they are going to attack you, yeah? That's the expectation. Just in case. Yeah.
It sounds like you're going into the conversation expecting something adversarial rather than learning from someone who, similar to a classroom, you don't expect an adversarial conversation with the teacher because you expect they know something, I don't, I'm here to learn. But if you go in knowing that the person has an opposing view, you automatically think, sort of like a sports team, this is a confrontation that I have to win.
Yeah.
And beat the other person.
That's so great. It's a zero-sum game, right? It's a sports competition. Someone's right and someone's wrong. At the end of it, it's going to be me or him or her, and it's going to be me. Yeah? Okay. Now imagine the same conversation. So you are engaging in the same conversation with someone who disagrees with you, who's on the other side of the political spectrum, but you expect them to be kind. You expect them to be open-minded. Would that change what you would do? Yeah? How might that change what you do? Yeah, in the front here.
Okay, hang on.
You know, you would try and project that because you'd want to be treated that way. I mean, I was in Israel one summer working for a legal clinic, and I went with an American group, and just this is a short story, I'll make it as short as possible,
but
it's a very contentious issue, and what I didn't like seeing was, you know, all these people that I was with were law students from the U.S., and they all had their own leaning, and they were so fixated on their ideology that if somebody in the group dissented on any one point, there was one person in particular who fell into a particular group, and I'm not going to say which one or whatever.
Don't do that.
They got very personal and mean with her, and really attacking to the point of where it was like, you're not listening to any valid point she has to make.
Right, so instead of
listening... And you don't like to be treated that way, so why are you treating mm-hmm. her that way? So in that scenario, yeah. I would hope that I would be willing to engage mm-hmm. and less anxious and willing to hear what that person has to say mm-hmm. because I'd want to be treated that way.
Yeah, so you would enter into the interaction with the way that you would want to be treated. You'd follow the golden rule. Yeah,
I don't
so
know
do
if that would
others.
Happen, but I mean, I don't
in,
know.
In,
if...
a, in a, an ideal hypothetical headspace, that's how you would engage, yeah. Yeah, they're up here in the front, right here.
Okay, right here.
I think if I was going to that conversation, I'd still try to check like all my facts beforehand okay. because I'd want to have an informed, open-minded conversation.
Okay.
So I'd still do fact checks, but it'd be like with a different attitude than if okay. the person was hostile.
So what would the different attitude be?
Well, I wouldn't really be trying to like fight them per se.
Okay.
I'd be more trying to like having an open discussion, trying to gain more from the conversation.
Okay, so you might go into the conversation wanting to be more engaging, more interactive, maybe learn something rather than fight. Yeah? Okay. So it turns out this is exactly what happens, and that our expectations lead us to act in ways that cause others to confirm those expectations. So you, if you go into a political discussion expecting the other person to argue with you, you treat them like they are going to argue with you. And it turns out, what happens when we think that people want to fight us? We get defensive. And in contrast, if we think that people are going to be kind to us when we engage in these kinds of discussions, we act in ways that perhaps are more open-minded. We maybe still get our facts straight, but we want to engage in conversation. And when people encounter us thinking that we are willing to be open and willing to exchange ideas, they do. So we reap what we sow, right? That's the whole point here. So this is initially labeled the Rosenthal effect, and the earliest studies of this are an expectancy effect. The early studies of this were with children in the classroom. And the researchers told teachers that some children were early bloomers. They were the super smart kids. Now, these kids were just regular kids, right? They were randomly assigned to be labeled high performers. But what happened is that the way that teachers engaged with those children labeled as high performers led the children to act in ways where that actually they became the high performers at the end of the year. So the teachers were given an expectation. That expectation influenced the teacher's behavior. And then the changes in the teacher's behavior impacted the student's performance. The same way that our expectations going into political discussions impact how people expect to engage with us and then change how they actually do engage with us. And so Hillary Clinton historically has been very reticent about doing interviews, particularly in the media. So she is very reserved and cold, but labeled as cold, because she feels like the media doesn't like her. She feels like the media doesn't give her a fair shake, and so she doesn't engage with them. She thinks that the media is going to be hostile to her, and in reaction, acts in a cold, distant way. So what ends up happening in the interviews is that the reporters come out of the interview and say, Hillary Clinton has a personality deficit disorder, and that in turn changes how Hillary Clinton is willing to engage with the news media. So she has this expectation that she's going to be labeled cold. She goes into the interview defensive. The interviewer picks up on this defensiveness, labels it coldness, and then the cycle begins again. And finally, we don't change our beliefs, even in the face of opposing evidence. So the consequences of these kinds of bias information searches is that retractions don't actually impact our beliefs that much. So when we find out that the thing that we thought was true isn't actually true, that misinformation persists even in the face of correction. And so my colleague here in the psych department, Colleen Seifert, has done a lot of this work also showing that misinformation persists even after correction. So for instance, people are given an explanation for a fact. They're given a belief. They report their belief and then are given information that either corrects the affirms the truth or corrects a falsehood. And so what you see is that immediately people are responsive to the correction, right? So they think that the facts become more true
and the misinformation becomes less true. But what happens over time is that that corrective piece of information is forgotten. So if you ask people 1 week later, if that thing that I told you was true or that thing that I told you was false, is it true or false? People forget. And so over time, their beliefs go back to their initial set points. So we don't maintain the correction. And so this happens when information is unattributed to a source, and it's more likely to happen when it's attributed to a source about which we already have an attitude. So in this case, President Trump. So we don't correct our beliefs over time. So you can see that these beliefs 1 week later are about the same as they were from the beginning. So just to summarize what the consequences are, biased information processing predicts what we think. It predicts what we do. It broadens gaps between people with different opinions. It changes how other people treat us. And those beliefs are particularly resistant to change. So they don't get better. So information can impact our beliefs. Yeah? So beliefs impact information, and information impacts our beliefs in the cycle. So what are we to do? Is this just about politics? Is these kinds of processes unique to the political domain? It turns out no. So the same biases emerge for things like health information seeking. So people are less likely to pay attention to doctors' recommendations when it contradicts their current practices. They don't go to the doctor. They don't listen to what the doctor says. They don't change their behavior. They're less likely to change their behavior when the doctor tells them to do something they don't want to do. And these are some data that I collected a few years ago and show that people who are already engaging in the behaviors advocated by a health prevention program are more likely to enroll in subsequent preventive efforts. And what this means is that the people for whom these tightly controlled intervention programs are designed are not the people who want to enroll in them. Right? So we are missing the people who could most benefit from these programs because the people who could benefit the most from these programs don't really want anything to do with them. We also see these issues emerge for when the issue becomes about morality. So if there's a right answer or a wrong answer, the gaps, the biases, the defensive processing becomes even stronger, leading to things like ostracism and an inability to have a productive conversation. So if you label the issue as an issue of morality, as one side is right and the other side is wrong, it's much harder to bridge those two perspectives together. And so what can we do? What can we do to reduce the bias? So we know that partisanship is at an all-time high. So Republicans think that Democrats are closed-minded, immoral, lazy, dishonest, and unintelligent. And Democrats think Republicans are closed-minded, dishonest, immoral, unintelligent, and lazy. Cold, negative feelings for the other party are on the rise. But our feelings about our own party have stayed the same. So it's not that we identify more with our group. It's that those guys are the worst, right? So it's about derogating the out-group. We are more likely, so we say that Republicans who say the Democratic Party makes them feel afraid, angry and frustrated. And Democrats say the Republican Party makes them feel afraid, angry, and frustrated. People feel like they don't learn from discussions with people on the other side of the aisle. So after a conversation, when you talk about politics with people you disagree with, you usually find you have blank than you thought. 61% of people say less in common. Having the conversation actually exacerbates the problem. What are we supposed to do? I'm done. Is there anything that we can do here? Partisanship is at an all-time high. We don't see the bridges. We don't see the connections. And if anything, trying to make it better makes it worse. Do we just throw our hands up and say, there's nothing to be done here? Well, it turns out we see more differences than are actually there. So if you look at data about where people, Republicans and Democrats are on a variety of issues, and then you ask people to estimate where people in the other party actually stand on the issues, what you see is that the discrepancies are much smaller than people actually think. So those black bars are the range of opinions with Democrats on the left and Republicans on the right. But the blue dots are where people think Democrats are, and the red dots are where people think Republicans are. So there's a greater spread in the colored dots than there is in the black bars. So we perceive more difference than there actually is. The issue is that we use different reasons when we think about political issues. So political liberals are more likely to evaluate the morality of arguments as a function of whether or not they harm other people. So is harm being done or is care provided? And fairness. So are people getting what they deserve in this outcome here? So you can see here, liberals are more likely to look at harm and fairness and less likely to consider these other moral dimensions here. Conservatives use all five moral dimensions when making decisions or evaluating the morality of a particular political issue. So in addition to the harm and fairness foundations of morality that liberals use, conservatives also can consider things like authority. So what do people in positions of power think about the issue? They look at in-group favoritism. Does this benefit my group or not? And they look at purity. So is this going to make things clean or dirty? And those different moral foundations change the way that people evaluate the same political arguments. So for instance, if you think about designing a conservation campaign, conservation is typically a liberal issue. And so when these campaigns are presented in the media, they're presented as things like conservation, care, and respect. That campaign is based on the moral foundation of harm. Harm versus care. Do no harm. Take care of the environment. So things like harm humans are causing to the environment, and that it's important for people to care about and protect the environment. And when you have arguments like this, what you see is that liberals are far more likely to endorse these messages than conservatives. Now, if you take the same message, the same idea, and you change the moral foundation on which the argument is designed, so for instance, you shift to a foundation of purity or sanctity, so things like the environment has been polluted and contaminated, and it's important for people to clean and purify the environment, now all of a sudden, you get people meeting in the middle. So here, this is the neutral condition, so people who did not see any message. And what you see is that liberals are more likely to endorse pro-environmental attitudes than conservatives. You see a replication of the bias for this harm-care condition, right? So liberals are more likely to support the message than conservatives. But when you frame the same issue on a different moral foundation, purity and sanctity, all of a sudden there are now no differences between liberals and conservatives in endorsement of pro-environmental attitudes. So we can meet people where they are. That's one thing that we can do. We can think about where people are coming from, and rather than saying your way is wrong and my way is right, we can think about, well, maybe they are thinking about this issue, maybe they are approaching the issue from a different place than where I am starting from. We can also focus on being right. So we can think about those accuracy motives. We can try and be detectives. So rather than focusing on defense and protection, we can think about, are our views actually accurate? We can be aware of bias. So we can seek out other points of view. We can pay attention to what the other side is saying. And we can refrain from moralizing. So rather than saying, I am right and you are wrong, we can think about where we can all meet in the middle. We can also be smart consumers of news. So we can learn how to be media literate. So learning what fake news looks like, we can consider the source of the message. We can seek out supporting sources on the internet. We can fact check what we have. And we can also ask the experts. And so I just want to return to what I hope I promised you at the beginning of the talk. So when do we discredit information we disagree with? Well, when we feel strongly about it, when we disagree with the message, when we dislike the source, when we're angry, or when we don't like the solutions, we are more likely to discredit information. Why do we discredit information we disagree with? When we want to defend our current beliefs and behaviors from attack, we're more likely to discredit information we disagree with. What are the consequences of discrediting information we disagree with? Well, it impacts our thoughts, our beliefs, and our behaviors, and also increases the divide, so we're less willing to see across the aisle. And how can we be less biased? We can focus on accuracy, we can be aware of other perspectives, we can refrain from moralizing, and we can try and meet people where they are. And so I just wanted to remind us all again, the take-home message from the talk is that our brains are really incredible. They're phenomenal. And we can take in so much information, we can process huge amounts of data. Sometimes those come with limitations of blind spots. Being aware of our biases can reduce errors in judgment. So we can process information, but we don't always. But being aware of what those blind spots are can help us be better information consumers. And so I want to thank you all for your attention tonight. I look forward to taking your questions. And thank you to my lab, the psychology department, and the library. So thank you so much.